Human beings have the most amazing capacity for talking themselves into believing absolutely ridiculous things when doing so happens to be convenient. That is endemic to our species. It's our biggest problem. Get used to this idea. I'm going to be returning to this theme over and over again all evening long for the rest of this. Now, I'm going to run through a lot of different criteria for achieving sustainability. Sustainability is thrown around. The word is thrown around willy-nilly. Politicians and bureaucrats are always saying, oh, sustainable this, and oh, that's sustainable. Like, for example, they'll say sustainably harvested lumber. Well, the lumber may be harvested in a gentle manner that doesn't destroy the forest ecosystem, but for it to be truly sustainable, not only do the chainsaws and the logging trucks have to be running on something other than petroleum, but the chainsaws and the logging trucks have to be manufactured using something other than petroleum. So you're going to start seeing this is a humongous task we have laying ahead of us. Right now we're making lots of solar panels and wind turbines, and that's a really good thing. We want to see renewable energy. What's going to really be impressive is when we're manufacturing solar panels and wind turbines using nothing but the energy from other solar panels and wind turbines. That will be a tough one. So I refer to what I call genuine, meaningful sustainability just as a way of distinguishing it from what people commonly refer to as sustainability. And when you start factoring in all the different criteria that I'm going to go over, you'll find that it's a dauntingly complex, remote, far-flung ideal. I'm reminded of the populations of Europe who spent 200 years building those cathedrals that many of us have seen and been astonished by, entire generations being born, growing old, and then dying before ever seeing the completion of these cathedrals. But unfortunately for us, we don't have 200 years to do this. We don't have 20 years to do this. We're already running up against certain problems, and very soon we're going to be really running up against elements of our lack of sustainability. But the good news is that we will achieve sustainability. There's not one shred of doubt about this. We are going to achieve sustainability. The only question is, are we going to do it voluntarily or involuntarily? And the longer we wait, the more of a wrenching, traumatic change this is going to be. So we really ought to get to work on this. So I'm going to run through a number of criteria here, and rules. What I like to begin with is the precautionary principle. It states that when the full consequences of a given action are not fully known, it's best to err on the side of caution. What a perfectly reasonable and prudent thing to do. For example, it should not be up to the government to prove that a new chemical compound is hazardous. It should be up to the chemical company to prove that it is not, and until that time, the chemical should not be put into widespread production. And a good place to apply the precautionary principle is this whole technology to the rescue idea. We can't just go on the assumption that technology is going to solve these problems for us, because I think there are various respects in which it is not. Another major rule with sustainability is that growth is unsustainable, period. Within a closed, finite system like a planet, or, for example, in the case of an island, you can't continue growing indefinitely. This is a graph showing a herd of reindeer that were released on an island as a temporary food source for the Coast Guard station. They released 29 reindeer. The Coast Guard abandoned the island and left the reindeer there. And in the next 20 years, they went up to 6,000 reindeer, at which point they fully outstripped their food source, and the population crashed, and there's now no longer any reindeer on St. Matthew's Island. Here's yeast in a petri dish in a laboratory. You feed them a food source, and their numbers grow until they outstrip the food, and then they crash. It's called culture collapse in this case. And now, guess who this is? This is us, everybody. We're going to be like yeast. This is the hockey stick graph. You've all seen this. Many of you have seen this. It's the common graph depicting how population rose very, very slowly throughout the majority of our history. Then all of a sudden, with the use of fossil fuels and industrialization, it has now shot upwards. Now, how can I sufficiently emphasize the following word? Obviously, we can't go on like this. It's just, population is like a gigantic pink elephant standing in the room. It's urinating on the floor, for God's sake. And so many people embrace the fundamental human right to procreate. And, of course, everybody loves babies. They're wonderful. And, so any politician is not going to start talking about this, because to do so would be to commit political suicide. So they're not talking about it. But no reasonable thing that any politician would suggest to address population would be nearly as bad as doing nothing. And if we don't do something, we're going to watch a very, very painful and ugly die-off in our species. And it's been shown that the best way to get poor populations to reduce their fertility rate, and those are the ones having the most children, is to provide health care and education for the people, especially the women. And therefore, a redistribution of the world's wealth is central to achieving sustainability. And we must come to terms also with how our wealth relates to poverty and suffering imposed elsewhere in the world, often at gunpoint. And meanwhile, while poor populations are having too many children, we in the wealthy countries are producing too many toilet seats, among other things. We're not producing so many children for our numbers. However, our consumption of the resources is far more harmful to the environment generally. So anyway, population and resource consumption, our best efforts at sustainability will be in vain if both of these things are not addressed. Non-renewable resources, petroleum, natural gas, coal, minerals and metals, everything, all that stuff, they're all non-renewable, and using them is unsustainable. For example, copper, since the use of virtually all electronic devices and electricity generally is based on copper, the use of electricity is unsustainable. I'm not going to suggest we stop using electricity, at least not before this presentation's over. But if we're going to hope to have an advanced industrialized civilization that will last many thousands of years, we're going to have to start using things very, very differently, producing various objects so that they will last a lot longer and then be truly meaningfully recyclable when they reach the end of their lifespan. Right now, probably the most crucial thing is, the two things are oil and natural gas. They're both just about to peak or probably have peaked. You've seen the Hubbert curve. How many of you haven't seen this graph, the Hubbert curve showing the peak oil bell curve? It shows the rise of oil consumption during the last century, and then that little dip is the Arab oil embargo, and then it goes right up to the present. That very top peak area is about early to middle this decade. And I think you can take it home, you can take it to the bank, you can write it down on a piece of paper, write down peak oil, July 2008, take that piece of paper home and stick it someplace where you'll run across it 5 years from now, because 5 years from now, historians will be saying that July 2008 was the all-time peak of world oil production. Within 5 years, certainly within 10 years, world oil production will be declining by something on the order of 5% annually. And if you think we have a sluggish economy, you just wait. We're going to be looking out over the smoldering ruins of what was once a reasonably vibrant economy, even today, much less a couple years ago. Now, you take all the solar panels and all the wind turbines in the world, put them all together into one massive renewable energy grid, they will not produce one thimble full of gasoline or diesel fuel around which 90% of our transportation is designed. I would suggest, I have an exercise for all of you. Tomorrow morning, have a really good breakfast, and then go out to your driveway and try pushing your car the distance that you can drive on 1 gallon of gas for which you paid about $2.50. You're going to discover that for $2.50 you bought essentially the physical labor of maybe a half dozen slaves doing grueling physical labor for a solid week. So you'll discover what a precious resource that our petroleum deposits have been. A lot of mainstream economists say, well, when peak oil happens, the prices will rise, and then the wise hand of the market will usher in all these other energy technologies, and we'll just transition over to these other things. And that sounds plausible enough until you factor in a number of items. One, the size and scale of the world energy infrastructure transition that needs to take place. This is going to make the Marshall Plan look like changing a light bulb. The time frame for this transition, the next 20 years, 30 years, and the shortcomings of the other energy sources, and I could run down a laundry list of those later, but not now because I'm in a hurry. And then you add into that, you might consider what sort of shape is our economy going to be in when our magnificent leaders suddenly discover, oh, we better do something about this. It's going to be about 20 years too late. History is going to look very favorably on Jimmy Carter, who put solar panels on the White House, and then he got denied a second term. Reagan got in, took the solar panels off, and that was that. Anyway, you factor in all these things, and there's little doubt in my mind, we're looking at some degree of collapse. things are just going to fold right up. We can't continue going the way we've been, and our so-called leaders are just not seeing this and not preparing for it in any meaningful way. And so the name of this presentation, I like to call it the elegant collapse, because we need to gently and lovingly massage this collapse into something that we can all live with. So it's toward a complete bottom-to-top restructuring of human civilization. Anyway, back to these various criteria for sustainability. Recycling of metals, a lot of people are quick to say, oh, you can recycle stuff. Well, you recycle a plastic bottle into plastic lumber. It's not the same thing. And with even recycling of metals, where theoretically you could take a metal object and make it into a whole additional new metal object. But with a little bit of metal is lost with each smelting process. So even the recycling of metals is not a truly sustainable answer to this issue. For example, you melt down an aluminum can, and because the metal's so thin, a tremendous amount of the aluminum is lost to oxidation, and you end up with maybe half of an aluminum can worth of aluminum out of that process. And then a lot of the metal also gets lost because it gets dispersed into the environment, where for no practical purpose will it ever be fully recovered or recycled. Like the wires from all those Christmas lights are such a frail type of copper that they'll never be recycled. They just get thrown into a hole in the ground. So what this means, where all these the unsustainability of all these materials are concerned, is that the our durable goods need to be made to last a lot longer. Everything from televisions to can openers to everything that we manufacture needs to be made to last as long as it possibly can. And then when it does reach the end of its lifespan, be fully restored, reconditioned, rebuilt, disassembled, or meaningfully recycled. And so I really don't think we can rely on the wise hand of the free market to get that to happen. It needs to be commanded by some sort of authority. Now, one good piece of news is that human labor is environmentally neutral, and human labor is something that we have a lot of, and it is a fully renewable resource, as long as we can eat. It just so happens that in agriculture, a real practical way to get a lot of food out of the field is to hire a lot of people to do it. Using this as an example, wherever any energy-intensive, chemically toxic agricultural or industrial process can be replaced with another process that instead uses lots of labor, that's exactly what we should be doing. We're the only species that doesn't have full employment. Now, I'm going to run through a few examples. I'd like to run through a lot more examples, but I want to get on to what comes after this. A tree falls down in the forest. It gets broken down into an extremely complex biological process. It produces no toxicity and no waste, and it ultimately results in another tree. That's a truly cyclical, infinitely sustainable system. It's been going on for millions of years, indeed. What we call recycling is when we take oil, we make it into plastic bottles, and then those plastic bottles are quote-unquote recycled into some of that plastic deck lumber, which then goes to a landfill when it reaches the end of its lifespan. That's not a cyclical process. It's a linear process, and it's ultimately not sustainable. I'm old enough that I remember when milk, soda pop, and beer all came in bottles that were not recycled. They were sent back to the bottling plant and refilled. And if we had people in real positions of leadership, you know, really leaders, we would have a standardized set of different sizes and shapes of bottles and jars that would be infinitely sent back and refilled over and over again. You'd be able to buy pickles in a jar one week that had peanut butter in it the week before. We could do this. It would be really easy. In order for a genuinely sustainable approach to building would be, as one example, build with earth, sand, and straw and other natural materials in such a way that they can break down into the soil and ultimately they could be made into another building. A good example of this are these mud dauber wasp nests. They've been doing this for millions of years, truly sustainable architecture. You got a number of cities in the United States, you can see through the broken asphalt, the old paving stones that they used to use. And within 20 or 30 years, there's going to be no asphalt because oil will be too expensive to mix with gravel and slather under a roadbed. And then concrete will be prohibitively expensive because Portland cement, the active ingredient, is based on coal or natural gas for the intense thermal process that manufactures it. So I really think we ought to return to using either paving stones or paving bricks. I
And remember, labor is environmentally neutral. We can hire these guys to do this stuff. I was in Italy when I saw these guys, and they were reinstalling these paving stones. They were just outside the Vatican. They estimated the paving stones to be 500 years old, and they're reinstalling them for the, how many times have they been installed, who knows. And so I thought it was just the most exquisite example of genuine, meaningful sustainability, these Italian men installing paving stones that their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers might have quarried 500 years ago. Well, mainstream politicians and bureaucrats appear hell-bent on trying to maintain our unsustainable automobile-dominated transportation paradigm with electric cars or plug-in hybrids. I really think that ultimately a more sustainable approach is going to be something like a electric mass transit, where steel wheels roll over steel rails in a very low-friction manner, making extremely efficient use of what would hopefully be solar and wind-powered electricity. And while the use of concrete and steel in one of these underground subway systems may not look very sustainable, and it isn't, at least ultimately it's a very enduring transportation system that could last for centuries with very little additional maintenance once the thing is built. I like the expression transportation triage. We need to build these things real quick while we still have some kind of a viable economy and some energy resources available to us. And instead of continuing to make urban design a slave to the automobile, let's create walkable and fun places to be. Biomimicry is a new discipline where they take nature's best ideas and try to use them in solving our environmental and manufacturing type problems. And my favorite example is given by Paul Hawken, where he talks about how a spider spits a tiny strand of web out of its behind, and this web is proportionately stronger than steel cable. The spider does this on demand at room temperature, and the only feedstock is dead bugs. Now, what an astonishing, elegant process. When our industrial processes even begin to approach this degree of elegance and sophistication, many of our environmental problems will be long behind us. Growing numbers of people are choosing to live in community. Yeah. And in traditional cultures, this keys into what someone was saying earlier, one of the worst punishments you could be given was to be ostracized by your community, to be exiled. You're no longer a part of the community. But suburbia has been a form of self-imposed exile. We come driving home in our little car, our garage door pops open by itself, and we drive in there, and we never even know the names of the people who live two doors down. It's just utterly bizarre. Oh, and then there are these crazy hippies in Portland. Kevin Danaher makes the example of you're on the Titanic and you know it's going down. You're standing there on the deck wondering what to do. All of a sudden, this other ocean liner pulls up next to you, and this ocean liner is solar and wind powered, and it's made out of natural, non-toxic materials. And there's a really fun dance party on the deck with lots of delicious organic food, and everybody looks really vibrant and alive. You're not going to have to be told that the Titanic is a crummy ship to be on. You're going to dive onto the deck of that other ship. So I'd like to think that Eco Village and on a larger note, the emerging eco-city sort of paradigm will be this sort of a lifeboat that will come along and save us. And if you'd like to learn more about the eco-village with which I'm associated, you can go to maitreyaecovillage.org. And one of the biggest pet peeves I have is that in order for market forces to govern a sustainable world, environmental and social costs must be accounted for. This guy, Adam Smith, is seen as the godfather of modern economic theory, and he's not that bad, as you might imagine. He had this really pretty reasonable idea. He just made the point that a free market working in the context of a small area with many small players was the ideal mechanism for regulating the manufacturing and distribution of goods and services. And this is a perfectly reasonable idea, but Smith's, since his death, his simple and reasonable ideas have now been distorted to mean, among other things, that shameless personal greed is somehow a good thing for the larger society. And countless economists and business people have now come to enthusiastically embrace the wise and invisible hand of the free market, because the market needs to decide all the stuff for it. Now, when I was in India, these rice merchants had maybe like a
200 or 300 square foot little space, and they would compete with these rice merchants to guarantee consistent price and quality. This is free market capitalism at its best. Unfortunately, though, what we're faced is so-called free market capitalism at its worst, as huge corporations eliminate competition, control public opinion, they buy lawmakers and write the laws we have on the books. They enshrine the absurd yardstick of gross domestic product as a measure of an economy's health, which means that two jet airliners can smash into each other, everybody dies, but that is a positive thing for the economy because all this money changed hands. And then my biggest pet peeve, outside of the actual structure of the monetary system itself, which just is way beyond being at all sustainable, is the externalization of the true environmental and social costs. Now, what do I mean by this? Say we pay $2.43 for a gallon of gas. That price reflects what it costs to pump it out of the ground, refine it, deliver it to a gas station, and sell it to customers. That price doesn't reflect the soon-to-be staggering costs of global climate change. It doesn't reflect the cost of respiratory disease from air pollution. It doesn't reflect the cost of auto accidents and automobile-dominated sprawl development. That $2.43 per gallon doesn't reflect the cost of occupying Iraq and Afghanistan. It doesn't reflect the cost of peak oil as we are just willy-nilly using up this extremely valuable resource just because it's there and we might as well use it. And if all these true costs were accounted for, then we'd be living in a very different world because gasoline would cost $10 or $20 a gallon and we'd live a very different life. We'd live in very different structures of our communities. And the same matter of externalized costs can be applied to everything we have in our world, everything we do. If it were applied to modern petrochemical-based agriculture, we would all be eating organic, locally grown food because it would be cheaper. Why would we do anything else? It'd be a no-brainer. If the true environmental and social costs were applied to the chemical industry, thousands of highly toxic chemicals would be quickly phased out because the chemical industry would have a strong incentive for finding non-toxic replacements for them. But when mainstream economists insist that market forces be allowed to determine what happens and yet deprive the market of anything approaching accurate information, the wise hand of the free market becomes something more like a blathering idiot hand of the free market. And I can't emphasize this enough. You wouldn't have this guy in charge of running your business. You know, you wouldn't hire a developmentally disabled adult to make the important decisions in your life, you know. So anyway, there is hope. The idea is that we'd have a complete restructuring of the tax system, and this has been talked about for 20 years at least. I read it in the Ecology of Commerce in the early 90s, but it's now finally started to be talked about a little tiny bit because of climate change, and it involves a restructuring of the tax system. Taxes placed on income are like taxes placed on our industriousness, our ambition, and our creativity, the very things that a society should be encouraging. So, you know, we don't want to tax the things we want to encourage. We want to tax the things we want to discourage. Let's place taxes on pollution, waste, environmental degradation, and human misery. You know, taxation is ultimately a form of disincentive, so you tax what you don't want, okay? Now, you know where I'm going with this. I'm going to talk about a tax on carbon or on fossil fuels or gasoline generally. And, of course, a lot of people complain that that would hurt poor families harder than wealthy families, and I expect that's always going to be the case, that people with money have a slightly easier go of it than people without money. But one way to deal with this would be to exempt the first $10,000 or $20,000 of income from taxation, and that way people who don't own a car and live a modest, environmentally balanced life style would be rewarded for their exemplary behavior by paying little or no taxes. So a good place to start with our tax shift would be to begin incrementally raising taxes on gasoline or on carbon fuels in general, which would then ripple out into other sectors of the economy like agriculture and manufacturing, plastics, and so forth. And on one hand, we don't want to shock the economy too much, but on the other hand, you can just imagine the oil companies would like to study this for 10 years. So we'll give them, say, 6 months, okay? We'll give you a 6-month warning, during which time you can begin preparing for rising fuel costs and restructuring your lifestyle in anticipation of transportation costs going up. And then over time, you would see that our tax revenue begins coming more and more from stuff we don't want and less from stuff we do want. Another version of this has been put forth by James Hansen of NASA, the prominent climate scientist many of you have heard about. He suggests a blanket tax on all fossil fuels right at the the wellhead, the mine, or the port of entry, and then they turn right around and give that tax right back to the American people. So each of us gets a check every month from this new tax. So the beauty of this is that it would be revenue neutral. It wouldn't be a rise in taxes, it would be a shifting in taxes, so the so-called conservatives wouldn't be able to complain that these darn liberals are raising taxes on us, but I expect they would complain anyway. And let me spell out a few things here. So many powerful economic interests have made so much money from such unsustainable activity for so long, and so many people enjoy such great levels of affluence, comfort, convenience, and entertainment, that achieving genuine, meaningful sustainability is going to be upsetting to people. Let's just get used to that idea. Therefore, our leaders must carry out dramatic, sweeping changes for which there may not be widespread popular support. We cannot allow our quote-unquote leaders to fall back on the plausible deniability of saying, oh, my hands are tied. I can't be expected to do dramatic, sweeping changes for which there isn't widespread popular support. So in other words, you're getting reelected to office next term is more important than saving the world. Is that what you're saying? You know, we cannot allow that anymore. That plausible deniability has to end. And so concurrent with this, in order to achieve widespread popular support for the public must be educated. Okay, that's economics. Now, John Kerry actually said that the U.S. is the greatest democracy on the face of the planet. Well, first off, I think democracy is overrated, but still, let's talk about democracy. For starters, this is nonsense. You look at any of the European countries, with the possible exception of Britain, and they have a much more functional form of democracy. And I'm going to talk about those in just a moment. But for starters, right here at home, we got to get the money out of the system. The best way to do that, I feel, is through publicly funded election campaigns. Now, a lot of the so-called conservatives, I have to go like this because they're not conservative at all. They're radical and dangerous, but they call themselves conservatives. They would complain that this is another frivolous expenditure of the hard-earned taxpayer money, spending it on publicly funded election campaigns. But actually, it would save us money because, say, spending $500,000 on a senator's campaign will relieve that senator of having to give $500 million in tax breaks and subsidies to the corporate interests who got him or her elected to office in the first place. So let's just pull out the stops and start paying for our campaigns so that they'll be on a level playing field and they'll actually work. Now, in our system of a winner-take-all democracy, 51% can get representation, and then 45% or 49% get nothing. This is like a winner-take-all system where it's really not that fair. Under the form of proportional representation used in almost all European countries, that addresses the system. Like, say, the people in this room, we are probably like the totally cool people, and we probably represent 10% of the population. So we would form the Totally Cool People Party, and we would get 10% of the votes, which would mean that we would get 10% of the seats in Parliament. So while we wouldn't have a majority, we would at least have representation, and our representatives could then build coalition with other people, and we'd have a meaningful say in how things are run. Now, another thing, instant runoff voting is something you're probably not going to hear about from the major media, but you remember the year 2000 when we were told that you got to either vote for Gore or Bush, you know, and you damn well better vote for Gore, otherwise we're going to end up with Bush. And meanwhile, millions of people wanted to vote for Ralph Nader, but they held their noses and voted for Gore, and he won the election, but he didn't get in. I don't know how to explain that. But that's like, basically, this is essentially the same thing as the good cop, bad cop ploy, where you're told, you better work with me, son, or else you're going to have to deal with him, you know, and I don't want to deal with him, and I didn't want to deal with Bush either. I don't want to vote for the lesser of two evils. I want to vote for the person that I want to vote for, and I want a system where I can actually do that. And under instant runoff voting, also known as preference voting, back in the year 2000, we could have voted, you rank your candidates in order of preference. We could have voted Ralph Nader, number one. John Hagelin was another interesting candidate at the time, number two. And then Al Gore, number three. And as your first two choices appeared not to be winning the election, then your vote would drop down and count toward the third choice. And then last but not least, where democracy and education are concerned, it's a tragic mistake to have put ourselves in the position of having a small handful of huge corporations to put ourselves in the position of these corporations spoon-feeding us this information, when in many cases they have a vested economic interest in keeping us uninformed. They don't want us to know what's going on. So while national public radio and television are routinely derided by conservatives as a flagrant waste of taxpayer dollars, on the contrary, we should increase national public media, not cut the funding for it, with the condition that all corporate underwriting be eliminated so that they would then be free to be fully honest and report the facts correctly. Okay, of the reasons why the solutions to our problems are not being implemented, are specifically not being implemented, we've talked about economics, we've talked about democracy and education. Now we're going to talk about what, in my opinion, is the single most important issue of them all. Human consciousness must change. Anytime I think about these things, I come back around to the same location every time. Human beings have got to somehow begin thinking differently. This is the response to the central premise of my presentation. Remember at the beginning, human beings have this amazing capacity for talking themselves into believing nonsense. You know, the idea that human consciousness must change for peace and environmental sanity to prevail has been articulated by people ranging from Albert Einstein to Shirley MacLaine. But what does this mean? You know, it's a pretty vague thing. Oh, human consciousness has to change. Well, either you're asleep or awake. What are you talking about? A classic definition of enlightenment is that one is enlightened to the extent that one feels unbounded, unconditional love for everyone. And that would be very convenient if we all woke up tomorrow morning feeling unbounded, unconditional love for everyone. But on the off chance that that doesn't happen, I'm prepared to settle for something a little less. I like to call it an enhanced faculty of discernment, a 25% increase in our ability to see what's in front of our eyes. Now, I'm going to give you a couple examples of this. Back in the 80s, I worked for this couple. We'll call them Barbie and Ken. They made a big pile of money with this technology startup, and when it came time for them to get their divorce, since there was a big pile of money, their divorce was a legal mud wrestling match, and you'd talk to him, and you'd get this perfectly reasonable-sounding story that made him sound reasonable and her sound insane, and you'd talk to her, and you get this other perfectly reasonable, plausible-sounding story that made her sound reasonable and him insane. And I just knew that the truth was somewhere in this vast gray chasm separating these two wildly different stories. Meanwhile, you talk to an Israeli and you talk to a Palestinian, you get two very different stories. There again, I would be willing to bet the truth is somewhere in this big gray area between these two stories. Perhaps the most heartbreaking example of this, back in the 1980s in Guatemala, the military would go into a village and they would round up all the teenage boys who were then essentially drafted, and they would then take a boy perhaps to another village, and they would single out some man they would point to, and they'd say, "See this man? This man is a communist. Therefore, this man is evil. Therefore, you must kill this man. And if you do not kill this man, then you are one of them, and we will kill you." And so going against everything his heart and soul was telling him, this poor young man would murder this guy. And from that moment forward, every waking moment of his life, he would spend talking himself into believing that what he had done was correct and right and appropriate and just. And there's the same man 10 years later, a brutal killer carrying out disappearances and torture during the day, and then, strangely enough, loving and playing with his children at night. Now, there's a psychological name for this. It's called cognitive dissonance. How many of you have heard about cognitive dissonance? Quite a good number. Good. It was first articulated in 1956 by a psychologist named Leon Festinger, and you can Google it and read about it. And they typically cite these examples that are so simple as to be laughable, in my opinion. I guess they function, but still. Say, for example, you like ice cream, but you're also trying to lose weight. So you'll invoke cognitive dissonance in your head where you'll talk yourself into believing that you're going to go on a diet next week, or your body doesn't look that bad, or ice cream's not that fattening. So you'll come up with this stuff. Or if you buy a Ford and your friend buys a Chevy, then you'll be constantly looking for Chevys that are broken down by the side of the road and Fords that are owned by happy owners and so forth to justify your decision to buy a Ford over a Chevy. And these examples seem rather... silly, really, in light of the fact that we just had the most exasperating, mind-boggling display of cognitive dissonance occupying the White House for the last 8 years. Now, I'm reminded of the build-up to the Iraq War, when they were going out of their way to find every piece of evidence to support the idea that Iraq was associated with 9/11 or they had weapons of mass destruction, and meanwhile, what were apparently greater numbers of more credible intelligence reports saying that Iraq wasn't involved in 9/11 and did not have weapons of mass destruction program, those pieces of evidence were swept aside. And it may be that Bush and his ilk were lying to us through their teeth, in which case the cognitive dissonance is then displayed when they look at themselves in the mirror in the morning and genuinely believe that their behavior is acceptable. So here it is, a situation where 4,000 U.S. soldiers and countless thousands of Iraqis have died as a result of a clearly identifiable psychological condition. Now, this is a very human phenomenon. I like to point at politicians and corporate executives, of course, but we all do this to some degree or another. This is endemic to our species. Untold millions of Americans believe the grand myths surrounding our country. We believe that the United States is inherently good and right, and that we're great champions of freedom and democracy the world over. We're trained to believe that our founding fathers were great visionaries doing what they did for strictly altruistic reasons. Untold millions of Americans are either oblivious to or just don't care that we're the one civilized country on earth without a national health care system, or that in spite of our fabulous wealth in this country, we had the highest incarceration rate of any country on earth, completely counterintuitive. Now, while virtually all human beings do this to some degree, I feel that it is somewhat more of an issue with the elites running the world than with average people. This is because not only do the elites wield much greater power than average people, but also because the elites have a greater economic incentive for talking themselves into believing lies and myths than average people do. As you rise up the ladder of success in politics or in corporate life, you're systematically groomed and conditioned to embrace the conventional wisdom of that world. And if you don't think and act like your peers, you're not going to get very far. So I think of it as a distillation process where, say, by the time Dick Cheney got to be Dick Cheney, literally thousands of other people had fallen by the wayside, not making it to the top. These are the people with too much honesty and integrity, people unwilling to backstab their adversaries, people insufficiently obsessed with money and power, those incapable of talking themselves into believing nonsense. So we end up with the awful situation of having exactly the wrong people running the world. And remember that a little bit of treachery will serve you quite well in politics or in corporate life. Now, meanwhile, here we are. Again, we're the totally cool people. And if we had a friend who was an abusive alcoholic, we'd be able to say all these funny things about human psychology. We'd be able to say, oh, gosh, he's in a lot of denial. How are we going to get him into counseling? How are we going to get him to do some soul searching? But meanwhile, where the people running the world are concerned, all we seem to be able to say is that guy is sleazy and that guy is greedy. You know, I don't think they're sleazy or greedy. I think they're deeply misguided, and we need to feel compassion for them more than scorn. And we need to look at the psychological state of those running the world. Human psychology is not a new science. Freud died in 1939. It's long past time that we began looking at this issue of human psychology. And I'm not suggesting that we needed to discuss psychology and human consciousness at the exclusion of activism. Indeed, we should be discussing our own psychology where activism is concerned, in the hope that our activism will stop being motivated by anger at all the bad people and instead be motivated by love and compassion and a commitment to leave a better world behind. You know, activists need to elevate their activism to a greater level of elegance and dignity, and I should say spirituality. And meanwhile, conversely, people in their various spiritual practices need to take on a more engaged commitment to create a better world. Observe your thoughts. What remains in the absence of your thoughts? What is it that exists between your thoughts? Do you ever think about your thoughts? Do our thoughts just pop into our heads out of nowhere? Or is it perhaps a little bit more likely, a little bit more plausible that our thoughts come percolating up from a subtler, quieter, more abstract place deep inside of us, a place of greater silence and clarity and peace? Would it be possible to begin perceiving our thoughts from somewhere closer to that place of silence, clarity, and peace. Think of the space between your thoughts. We all have a vast reservoir of silence deep inside of us. The clarity and truth residing in that place of silence would eliminate much of the denial and delusion exhibited by human beings. Okay? Not surprisingly, we live in a society that feels threatened by silence. How often do you go into a party or a restaurant or a cafe where there's constant music going on? There's not a person in the room who's actually listening to that music. It's like wallpaper just to take up the space in the air. Have you ever noticed how men seem to love playing golf and fishing? My personal theory on this is that this is because golf and fishing are the closest that a lot of these men ever get to a meditation practice. But if they want to relax and clear their minds, maybe they should just relax and clear their minds. If we owned a car, we would be considered foolish if we didn't keep the engine tuned up and keep the oil changed. But meanwhile, we have this far more complicated machine, and it's called a human nervous system. What could make more sense than taking a little time every day to keep it running smoothly? I can think of nothing better for addressing the central premise of this presentation, our very human capacity for talking ourselves into believing nonsense, than a regular practice of saturating our minds in that inner place of greater silence and clarity and peace. It is within that place of silence that we all share a certain very palpable oneness. Now, I'm clearly biased in favor of meditation, but there are lots of things you can do to achieve this. Walking in nature, yoga, making love, drumming, singing, dancing, gardening, or, you know, there's any combination, like, say, a couple of special friends, they meditate, have a nice long meditation, then they do massage and Reiki on each other, and then they make love. Now, that would be really good, because it would be a subversive thing to do, because they would be so happy that they wouldn't have any interest in going to the mall the next day. You know, so happy people make lousy consumers. That's where what I'm saying really, you know, yeah. Now, meanwhile, if you've been raised in this dysfunctional society, chances are you've been damaged like me. You are one of the wounded. You can join the club. Clearing away the clutter is the converse to looking inside. It's the psychological clutter that prevents us from looking inside and knowing our true selves. Now, despite the fact that mainstream science has its heels dug in, adamantly denying it, a lot of scientific research is pointing to a web or a field of energetic intelligence that permeates the universe and ties us all together. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, calls it nature's mind. Stephen Hawking calls it the mind of God. Modern medical science has brought us many thousands of so-called near-death experiences where people die and then they're brought back to share the experience. In some cases, they're able to explain in precise detail what was going on in the operating room or at the scene of the accident while people were struggling to save their lives. This at a time when there was no brain activity, no breath, and no heartbeat. They were clinically dead as a doornail, and yet they were able to talk about the experience. So what this points to at this pivotal moment in history is that there's a very convincing case to be made that in addition to the bounty to be had in developing our own consciousness, there is a web of connectivity that joins us with all of creation. And presumably this divine matrix, to some extent, is available to those of us who clear enough of the clutter and become sufficiently steeped in silence and clarity. And if it's possible for sentient intelligence to convey itself or to exist outside of a biological body, then all bets are off. There can be intelligent spirit beings who are capable of communicating with us and acting in the physical world. And quite simply, a scientifically arguable case can be made for the existence of God. And I'm not talking about a white man with a beard up in heaven, you know. Yes. The single most important, and I should say most politically subversive thing we can do is to develop our consciousness. The power structure running the planet doesn't want vibrant, dynamic, discerning, engaged, happy people. Again, happy people make lousy consumers. The powers that be want sheep. They want people just functional enough to punch a time clock, but not so discerning and discriminating that they'd be able to see the truth that lies beneath all the cultural myths. So again,
just on an individual basis, developing one's consciousness makes tremendous sense, but when you factor in the state of the world and how the world would benefit from a population of vibrant, dynamic people who are fully plugged into the web of intelligence that permeates the universe, looking inside, doing the work, and cultivating one's consciousness is quite simply the only game in town. And through the web of connectivity already discussed, as we develop and heal ourselves, it becomes easier for others to do the same thing. Indeed, the very fact that I'm saying these words increases the likelihood that someone elsewhere in the world is also having a conversation like this. So a great tipping point of world consciousness may very well be upon us at a time when it's needed more than ever. A framework on which to construct hope is readily available to us. Genuine, meaningful sustainability can be achieved, and the human family can rise like a phoenix from the ashes of the dominant paradigm, which is already starting to crash around us. Thank you very much.